Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Doctor, The Hitman, and the Motorcycle Gang. The true story of one of New Jersey's most notorious murder-for-hire plots. By Annie McCormick. Narrated by Kate Zane. Prologue. When 35-year-old Kimberly Pack received the phone call from the Atlantic County Prosecutor's Office asking her and her husband to clear their schedules for the following Tuesday, January 9, 2018, she said, "We'll be there." But the mother of two young boys did not get overly excited, or for that matter, excited at all. When asked later exactly how she felt on the day she received this call, Kim answered, "Numb." Kim had been down this road many times before, and she was not expecting much. It was now 2018, and she assumed this was just another meeting about her mother's unsolved murder in 2012. A newly appointed Atlantic County prosecutor named Damon Tyner had taken office in the spring of 2017, and one of the first people he called was Kimberly Pack. The new prosecutor promised to put new resources into the dormant investigation of the murder of her mother, April Kaufman, who was 47 at the time of her death. Tyner also promised to give frequent updates and to share whatever information he could along the way. For the first time, Kim felt that someone in a position of authority was on her side, really putting forth a major effort. Still, she felt cautiously optimistic at best, as false hopes had also become a normal part of her life. The mere fact that Prosecutor Tyner had reached out when he took office felt significant. For years, she'd received few updates, and met resistance whenever she made an inquiry regarding the investigation. The very day of April's murder, it took detectives hours to tell Kim that they were investigating a homicide and that her mother had not died a natural death. Kim had already figured as much by the presence of the yellow crime scene tape and the news helicopters hovering above. When the day arrived for the meeting with the prosecutor's office, Kim's husband Randy had taken off work and was in the shower getting ready for their 1 p.m. meeting when the phone rang around 11 a.m. The location of the meeting had changed from the prosecutor's office in Mays Landing to the FBI field office in Northfield. The couple was asked to come as soon as possible. Kim knew this was not just another meeting. When the Packs walked into the FBI's second-floor office, they were greeted by FBI Special Agent Dan Garibrandt. Garibrandt, a 25-year veteran of the FBI, had promised Kim that he would find the person or persons responsible for her death and see to it that they were brought to justice, no matter who they were or how long it took. That day had arrived. Garibrandt ushered Kim and Randy into a spacious conference room, where the team of people responsible for untangling one of the most notorious murder-for-hire plots in New Jersey history stood. Detective Jim Scopa from the Atlantic County Prosecutor's Office, flanked by Chief Assistant Prosecutor Seth Levy and First Assistant Prosecutor Kerry Schill, stood next to the team's new leader, Prosecutor Damon Tyner. Tyner placed a hand on Kim's shoulder, looked her in the eye, and said softly, "We got 'em. We got all of them." Every person in the room then proceeded to hug Kim, who was overcome with emotion, and shake hands with Randy before sitting them down and sharing some of the gruesome details. Dr. James Kaufman, Kim's stepfather, and the man she had long suspected of killing her mother, had been arrested and charged with murder. In an unforeseen twist, investigators had found that Jim, the fidgety, nervous, physically unprepossessing doctor, was heavily involved with an outlaw South Jersey biker gang in what prosecutors described as an elaborate and lucrative drug-dealing scheme. Kim knew that leading up to her mother's death, her mother had uncovered some of the truth about some of Jim's dirty deals and his labyrinth of lies. Prosecutors say that when she found out and threatened to expose the illicit pill mill he was running out of his medical office, a contract on her life was set in motion. The months following the meeting at the FBI office in Northfield would begin what Kim hoped would be the final chapter of her years-long journey in fighting for and ultimately finding justice for her mother. But the case was far from over, and was still to bring many new and disturbing details to light. The tangled web involving the doctor, the hitman, and the motorcycle gang was about to unravel. Chapter 1. Premonitions. I feel like I'm on borrowed time here. April Kaufman's familiar throaty laugh filled listeners' ears when she spoke those words on May 9, 2012. She was live on her radio program, The King Arthur Show, in the Ocean City, New Jersey studio of WIBG-FM with her co-host, King Arthur Gropper. Kaufman was in the midst of thanking politicians, including New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, New Jersey Congressman Frank Lobiondo, and the Secretary of Veterans Affairs General Eric Shinseki, who had helped with her philanthropic work on behalf of local veterans. Her comment followed a joking remark about thinking that her microphone was cut off. But April Kaufman really was on borrowed time. That day was a high point for her, marking a moment of great affirmation. April, a staunch advocate for the men and women of the military, had just received the distinguished New Jersey State Governor's Jefferson Award for her work on veterans' behalf. April was a force. She could get things done thanks to her outsized gifts of tenacity, passion, and charm. And it didn't hurt that she was gorgeous. At 47 years old, with her tall, curvy body, blonde hair, and stunning looks, she was both sexy and smart. When she walked into a room, she was captivating. Today had brought the satisfaction of knowing that her years of hard work, on an issue she cared about so much, had been recognized. Two guests had joined April and King Arthur today, Bob Greco and Sam Fiocchi. They were both active in the political life of nearby Cumberland County, Greco as Republican Party chairman and Fiocchi as a county freeholder. The microphone went hot, the on-air sign lit up in red. Today's topic would be the good news about TRICARE, an insurer for military veterans. Shore Medical was now accepting it, and veterans across the area had April to thank. She had successfully advocated for this while juggling her other volunteer work with the Wounded Warriors Project, the United States Coast Guard, the Southern Shore Chapter of the American Red Cross, and the Atlantic County Toys for Kids program. "I did the work," April went on. "I put my boots on the ground and lobbied using my own money, time, and airfare." You could hear the emotion in her voice. April was savoring her accomplishment. At the same time, she was deeply affected by the hard fight to win. Her comments then took a more personal turn. "My bottom line, if nothing else, is to leave my legacy on this planet to my beautiful daughter and grandchildren." April paused and gave another throaty laugh, then jokingly proposed that she might be eligible for a military honor given to some fallen veterans. "Hey, could I get a flyover at my funeral now?" She mused that people could really say, "Here was an American citizen who really stood up and dug her heels in and yelled fire and expected it to be put out." To understand how emotional April was during this broadcast, you have to understand the enormity of what she had just accomplished as a civilian volunteer. TRICARE, which is paid for by the Pentagon, provides health care to more than 5 million Americans. Shore Medical is one of the main hospitals serving the Jersey Shore area. The plan provides health care services for active-duty United States military and retirees with 20 or more years of service, as well as to their dependents. April took on the cause after hearing about the long treks that veterans living in Atlantic County had to make in order to undergo dialysis, radiation, and chemotherapy treatments. No local medical facility providing these types of care accepted TRICARE. School buses would take more than a dozen patients from Atlantic County to the VA hospital in Delaware, more than a 2-hour drive. Then the radiation patients would transfer to a second bus and ride another hour and a half to the Veterans Hospital in Philadelphia. Some of the radiation patients could opt to stay in a hotel room overnight if they felt too sick from their treatment. The dialysis patients in Delaware did not have that option. The school buses shuttling the veterans had no bathrooms, uncomfortable seats, and no air conditioning. Many of the veterans were elderly, some in their 80s. No family members were allowed on the bus. The bathroom stops were limited. Side effects from some of the treatments include frequent urination and an inability to control bowels. After several accidents on the bus, the group dubbed themselves the Coffee Can Gang, since coffee cans were their only option to relieve themselves. Some who had accidents were too embarrassed to return. Hearing that story would appall anyone, but April Kaufman went beyond being appalled. Bob Frollo, head of Veteran Services for Atlantic County and a veteran himself, already had the issue on his radar. He had begun a petition-signing campaign to push for improvements. Frollo had also reached out to Shore Medical Center and was working closely with Shore's CEO at the time, Rick Pittman. He had already run into walls at Veterans Affairs, and he needed all the help and support he could garner. Rick Pittman recalls how, when April entered the picture, she brought a burst of energy to bear on solving the problem. The first time he met April, he was struck by her beauty, her enthusiasm, and her passion for the people she affectionately called her military heroes. April had been joined in this cause by her husband, Dr. James Kaufman, an endocrinologist who treated many veterans in his practice. Dr. Kaufman had a working relationship with the hospital and had a good reputation. Since 1990, he served at the hospital as their director of metabolic care. The Kaufmans worked together to bring TRICARE coverage to local veterans. As part of the campaign, Congressman Frank Lobiondo, whose district included parts of South Jersey, sent a letter jointly with Senator Bob Menendez to General Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, explaining the need for improved health care in the region. April wanted to meet Shinseki to make sure he got the message. As was her style, she made it happen. The National Association for Uniformed Services, NAS, had its scheduled annual conference at Fort Belvoir in Virginia on Saturday, November 6, 2010. April discovered that you do not have to have a military background to attend the NAS event, so she signed up. She called Representative Lobiondo's office for help in arranging to speak with General Shinseki one-on-one. Lobiondo's office was on board. Rick Pittman remembers arriving to pick up the couple early that Saturday morning at 5 a.m. The Kaufmans lived in a large house in Linwood, New Jersey, an affluent town in Atlantic County just over the bridge from the beaches of the New Jersey shore. Jim stood at the end of the driveway ready to go. Then April came out, and the three headed on their road trip. They planned to drive to Virginia and head back the same day. For Pittman, finding a solution to this problem was personal. He comes from a military family. In 1966, the day he graduated from the University of Scranton, he went into the Army. Pittman landed in Vietnam and served in the 313th Signal Company and 199th Light Infantry Brigade from 1969 to 1970, eventually retiring as a first lieutenant. Pittman assumed the Kaufmans had military ties as well because they were so passionate about this issue. During the long drive south, he brought up his time in Vietnam, and Dr. Kaufman said that he too served in Vietnam in the Special Forces. The conversation, however, was brief and vague. All the doctor would say was that he had been sent all around. Pittman found this strange. Most Vietnam veterans remember very clearly where they served in Vietnam. However, Pittman also knew that many had suffered life-altering traumatic events. Veterans witnessed tremendous suffering and loss of life, and the images they took home were too much for some to want to recall. Maybe, Pittman thought, Jim had one of those experiences in Vietnam. he didn't bring it up again. The trio arrived at the conference and waited for the question and answer portion of the meeting to begin. April did ask a few questions, but they still felt they needed one-on-one FaceTime with General Shinseki. Jim decided he would corner Shinseki in the men's room and ask his questions. Pittman was impressed at the couple's relentlessness. The trio returned home happy with what they'd done and hopeful about a response. Sources inside the NOS told Pittman that the paperwork outlining a deal to contract military dialysis services had sat on the secretary's desk for months. But shortly after their visit, Shinseki signed the papers. Soon after that, Rick Pittman retired from Shore Medical, and Ron Johnson took over as CEO. He too was willing to accept TRICARE, but the change in coverage inched along on a bureaucratic timeline. In December of 2011, over a year after attending the NOS conference, April was finally able to make the exciting announcement. In May, Ron Johnson announced that the hospital would accept TRICARE starting in June. Dr. Kaufman had already announced the previous December that he would accept TRICARE at his offices. Yet a few months before the announcement, in the fall of 2011, April had felt frustrated with her husband. The paperwork that would allow his practice to accept TRICARE still sat on her husband's pile of paperwork on his desk. Why wasn't he as eager as she was on this issue they had been pushing so hard for? Jim was a veteran himself. There was even an article mentioning his service hanging on the wall in the office. Wasn't he proud as a veteran to provide his services to the men and women of the military? "I'll get to it," he kept saying. Jim's military service had played a large part in kindling April's passion for helping veterans. April and Jim had hosted dinners for men and women serving in the Coast Guard during Operation Fireside, a Red Cross project placing cadets in homes for holiday dinners. Every year, April cooked a massive Thanksgiving dinner and opened her home for the cadets. The couple ordered stretch limos to shuttle the cadets in lavish style to and from the local Coast Guard base. A few years earlier, April had told her best friend, Peg O'Boyle, that Jim had received his Purple Heart in the mail. Apparently, he had lost his medal and ordered a replacement on eBay to replace the one he was awarded. Peg's antennae went up, but she could not figure out why he would lie. She had seen him multiple times wearing his green beret with the military insignia. Even as April became more enmeshed in assisting veterans with their issues, her own veterans' issues came to a head. Around December of 2011, April learned for sure that Jim had lied about serving in the military. "If I tell everyone, it looks like I knew it," she confided to one of her closest friends, Lee Darby. When April first confronted Jim about this, his response, according to close friends, was disturbing. "If you tell, I will put a bullet in your head and in your face." April was not going to let her secret knowledge about her husband ruin the broadcast on May 9th. She even spoke about learning the news about TRICARE with her husband. "I said to my husband last night while having dinner at the Northfield Diner, looking right at him, and it was a little bittersweet, and I was emotional. I did cry a little, and I didn't think I would. I looked at him last night and said, 'I'm out of a job.'" She laughed while contemplating what was next. "So you guys are going to have to give me a new crusade. I'm thinking homelessness and veterans are big issues, and I think I might just slide over there." When the broadcast was over, April said to Gropper, "We're going to go out and have a bite and have a drink." Gropper had work to do and declined to join them. Around 4:15, April, Fiocchi, and Greco headed to yesterday's bar, a beach shack-style bar in the small community of Marmora. April had a Stoli vodka on the rocks, and according to the bartender, she was upbeat and chatty. The three friends left around 5:50 p.m. April paid cash for the tab and headed home. While she was still at the bar, Jim sent her a text around 5 p.m. saying, "I'm home." What happened the rest of the night is mostly from Jim's perspective. The accounts of what he said transpired that evening would change years later. Late that night, April and Jim were playing with April's new iPhone, transitioning from her BlackBerry to the phone. The couple were trying to figure out how to work Siri and the new apps and features, including talk to text. While they tried to figure out the phone, Suzanne DeVito, April's close friend and a pharmaceutical representative who frequented Jim's office, texted her about plans later that week. April, Jim, Suzanne, and three others were going to attend a show at the Comedy Shop, and Suzanne wanted to change their dinner reservations. April and Suzanne went back and forth about where to go for dinner. Suzanne, as a drug representative, had held breakfasts at Jim's practice for years. Jim had never instructed Suzanne before about how to enter his office, but tonight he wrote, "When you get there, if no one is available to open the door, use my cell phone." Suzanne texted April she was to get a reservation at Cafe 2825, a popular Atlantic City restaurant. The two said goodnight. Overnight, others received strange messages from April's phone. A handful of people received forwarded emails from April, some dated months before. They arrived in batches. Gropper, her radio co-host, said his was a political joke. He wasn't the only one to get flooded with forwarded emails dated back days to months earlier, all from April's new phone. They began coming in around 1:45 in the morning and ended around 4 a.m., a surprising time for them to receive a message from April. People who worked with her on veterans issues, like her good friends Donna Clementoni and Bob Frollo, woke up with their inboxes full of the forwarded messages and noticed more recipients CC'd. All were months-old emails that she had previously sent. Donna was perplexed when she sorted through them the next morning. April had already responded to these emails months earlier. Then she noticed they were not all forwards. There were several responses from April to the emails dated months before. April's responses appeared to have been typed at 1:30 in the morning. Regarding invitation to a tour, February 24, 2012, 5:54 and 35 seconds p.m., 1:35 a.m. I would love to do a tour sometime and feature this on my show. The tour referenced in the email was on March 15th, and Donna and April had already moved on to other projects. Why was April responding to her about it again? Regarding employer support of the Guard, January 23, 2012, 8:51 p.m., 1:33 a.m. These types of stories happen too much. Another email about a subject that Donna and April had already discussed. The email April responded to was sent months prior. In the coming days, more people would come forward and say they received forwards of old emails, too. The last text message from April's phone was sent at 3:27 on the morning of May 10th to Billy Gonzalez. Billy was a young man April had employed for years to do odd jobs around her home. One of those jobs was to take care of her pet birds and clean their cages. It read, "See you in the morning." Billy had never received a reminder text from April in the 5 years he'd worked for her. Chapter 2. Mom's Dead. As Kim Pack drove to her morning appointments on May 10, 2012, she looked up to blue skies and puffy white clouds and took in the distinct scent in the air. It was the subtle, comforting, and familiar bouquet of springtime in Atlantic City, a mix of ocean breezes with the earthy aroma from temperatures rising over 70 degrees. Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial start of summer, was just around the corner. After that, the summer season would begin. That would bring masses of weekend shoregoers, mostly from the Philadelphia suburbs, southeast Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey, descending on Atlantic City, Margate, Ventnor, Longport, and Ocean City. The tourists would shatter the local residents' peace and calm, filling the lonely beaches and cramming the normally traffic-free roadways for the next 5 months. Normally, Kim would have enjoyed the lulling warm air for at least a moment. On this Thursday morning, her mind was elsewhere, and she was worried. By mid-morning, Kim still had not heard back from her mother, April Kaufman. Kim's morning had been its usual routine, rushing her two boys, ages 5 and 18 months, to daycare. Kim, a successful pharmaceutical sales representative, had a busy day ahead which included meetings and lunches with medical offices in her coverage area on the Jersey Shore. She had scheduled time this morning to take a call with her good friend and business partner, Suzanne DeVito, about a timeshare she was thinking of purchasing. Kim, her boys, and her husband Randy traveled with April several times a year to Disney World in Orlando, Florida, and a timeshare there would make sense. Kim wanted to speak with her mom before she arrived at her 11:45 lunch meeting at a physician's office in Ocean City. Pharmaceutical representatives often host lunches to pitch their drugs to doctors' offices. Once inside, she could not take personal calls since she had to focus on explaining the products. It's a high-pressure job. Every rep has a quota to meet each month. Kim and April usually spoke every morning. Kim mentally replayed the past few hours. Could she have missed a call from her mom? She scrolled through her phone, checking her call history. She had first tried April's home phone around 8 a.m., and again shortly after that. Then she called twice to her mom's cell phone, sent a text, but never received a response. Her mother was an early riser. Usually she was dressed by 5 or 6 a.m. You could expect to see April's platinum blonde hair perfectly in place. With years of cosmetology experience, she applied her makeup with professional precision, using eyeshadow and eyeliner to make her captivating green eyes pop even more. Pink lip gloss completed her look with a frosty pout. Kim shared her mother's beauty. They were almost lookalikes, except for Kim being petite and several inches shorter. Kim's smile, like her mom's, lights up a room, and her skin always had a sun-kissed glow as if she'd just stepped off the beach. Mother and daughter had a close sisterly bond since April had Kim when she was just 17. Kim had taken on the traits of a mini-adult, a worrier, always doing the right thing, excelling in school and completing college early. In contrast, April had graduated from the School of Hard Knocks. Nothing slowed her down. A committed, diligent worker, April made her business ideas and later her philanthropic efforts, especially for veterans, come to fruition. As her friends would say, April always shot for the stars and never missed. April loved to work a room and hold court on the radio. Kim had an engaging personality, but she avoided the limelight her mom was drawn to. Kim thought of reasons why April hadn't responded to her calls. Maybe April had the TV on loud in her kitchen with the coffee machine brewing. With her philanthropy projects, the beauty salon she owned, and her radio host duties, April was known to have a phone to each ear while texting on her BlackBerry. Most mornings, Kim would bring Starbucks over after dropping off the boys. Often, April would pull out their Disney mugs and have Kim try different teas she was always collecting. Sometimes the two would meet up for breakfast at the Northfield Diner. Every single morning, the mother and daughter either spoke to each other or saw each other. Kim had texted April again around 9 a.m. "Hi, where are you?" In Kim's rush, she could have sworn her mom wrote back just after 10 a.m. with a vague response to Kim's request to meet for a late lunch. But now, as Kim scrolled through her phone, she saw nothing. Before 11 a.m., she texted her mom again. As Kim hit send, the call she'd expected from her friend Suzanne came through. Kim pulled over into a parking lot near the doctor's office where she was going for lunch. She figured she'd talk to April after Suzanne's call ended, but while still speaking to Suzanne, another call began beeping through. The name Jim Kaufman appeared on her phone. Suzanne was a close, longtime friend of Kim and April's, and she knew about Kim's shaky relationship with her stepdad. After 10 years...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?